our second presenter is Timothy Fuller. He earned his VA from Kenyon College and his PhD in political science from Johns Hopkins. He's currently the Lloyd E. Warner Distinguished Service Professor at Colorado College, where he's taught since 1965. He was for many years dean of the college, dean of the faculty, and the sometime president, acting president, I believe. He has published widely and has edited numerous books, especially the works of Michael Oakeshott. Among these is The Voice of Liberal Learning, Michael Oakeshott on Education. He is also on the board of the American Academy for Liberal Education and of the Association for Core Texts and Curriculum. And we were talking earlier, George Carey, that wonderful volume of the Political Science Review you published with the Oakeshott Symposium, which Tim did, was one of the best things I've read on Oakeshott. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Tim to the podium.
First, I want to thank the Philadelphia Society for inviting me. This is the first time I've had the privilege of attending one of your meetings. And because I know a number of people who have been long associated with it, I had a certain vision of what it would be like. And after spending this morning's sessions, I now realize that it's not exactly what I imagined. It seems to be, among other things, the Center for the Study of Popular Culture. So I may have to revise some of my views. One other preliminary remark. I suppose it's an example of sinful pride to say that since we're talking about the university and the transmission of culture, that I had the privilege of teaching Todd as an undergraduate at Colorado College. And so I think that might provide us some empirical evidence that there is a culture and it does get transmitted. I take no credit for that, but I was happy to be present for the occasion. Also, I had conceived my remarks originally to say something about the history of the university, briefly, about ancient academies, the monastic and cathedral schools, the medieval university, the humanistic university of the early modern period, and then the advent of the university as we know it now. But after listening to the remarkably stimulating panels this morning of my good friends, Dwight Lee, Paul Cantor, and Nick Gillespie especially, with whom I have joined in discussions of this sort before, I was struck by the fact that almost everything I have to say will be framed by a kind of an ironic sense, which they imparted to all the subsequent discussions at this meeting. I was particularly interested to learn, for example, that culture is a tireless meaning production machine continually riffing off itself. I find that an intriguing idea, which I tend to think about more. But let me say that, in a way, what we did this morning was to reproduce a version of the conflict that exists today over the definition of the university and its role, a conflict that is fought out every day in almost every college and university in the country. There are various ways of characterizing it. One is the question whether the university as we now have it is a vehicle for the transmission of culture, the transmission of an inheritance, whether it's a vehicle for the transformation of culture, where whatever goes on there is understood to be a resource for imaginative departures into unanticipated realms, and then whether there is something we can talk about meaningfully called a tradition, which could be the mediator of transmission and transformation, which would echo the opening remarks last night of Attorney General Meese that Philadelphia Society is devoted to tradition and innovation. Can tradition as a mediator of this kind be discussed meaningfully. Among the things that we've heard today in thinking about a question like that is that there is an enormous proliferation of identities, of roles, of options for people to follow. And sometimes characterized, as it was at one point today, that the mainstream is dead, that everyone wants to be a mutant. I'm not going to comment at length on that idea. I understand the point of it, and there certainly is evidence of it in our culture. But I will say this, as someone who regularly teaches undergraduates, that students are much more complex than that. And there are undoubtedly some who wish to be mutants, but there are others who wish to have an anchor in something which we might loosely call for the moment the tradition. Is there, for example, any meaning left to the proposition that was quoted to me all the time when I was an undergraduate, that one of the tasks of liberal learning is to know the best that has been thought and said? Is there a permanent meaning that can be conveyed? These are questions which are highly debated now in universities and make it very difficult for the role of the university to be given an adequate and agreed-upon definition. Because from a certain point of view, our task should be to conserve the inheritance that we have. But from another point of view, which in some ways is dominant at the present time, the task is to be open and to be current, to accept that there is no consensus on value, and to fear rendering judgments in the areas of value or becoming judgmental. Should the university celebrate the new, or should it be, in a somewhat curmudgeonly fashion, the institution in society which is reluctant to baptize the new and to be slow to change, to render its judgment over a long period of time rather than immediately? In other words, when we talk about the tradition, we also have to understand that part of the tradition that is in the universities today is a kind of skepticism or anti-traditionalism, and that has become a feature or a habit of or a turn of mind of many of the people who are responsible for what the university does. Another factor to be considered in what I'm characterizing really here as reflections on how to think about the role of the university rather than trying to give a definitive answer to it. An issue which emerged implicitly in our discussions previously but was only addressed explicitly once or twice, and that is the question of transcendence. The desire for self-expression, the desire to be mutant, the desire to be creative, the desire to be imaginative, the desire to be different, are all real features of the way we live now. But at the same time, there is a brooding sense, in my opinion, in much of what goes on in the universities, that something is missing in the pursuit of those things, which has to be addressed in some other way, and the question is how to do so. In order to meditate a bit further on that, let me give a characterization of what I think the attitude is that I'm alluding to, not because I'm endorsing what I'm about to describe, but because I think it's hard to be in any university today without encountering it in some significant form. And it goes something along these lines. This is an anxious and pragmatic age, which seems to have abandoned or lost touch with transcendence. We seem to be leaving the era that began five centuries ago, which included global exploration, Renaissance, Reformation, scientific revolution, and enlightenment. Our time seems to be both a departure from where we have been and the harbinger of a future realignment which remains obscure. And this is evident in the declining persuasiveness that many feel in 20th century analytical and technical thought as means to help us clarify ourselves to ourselves. In the midst of technical mastery and intellectual confusion, there are those who understand themselves as living, to use the famous phrase of Hannah Arendt, between past and future, at the intersection of what has been and what is overtaking us. And the crisis of transcendence is that, from the current point of view, it is very often felt that the resources of antiquity will be insufficient, even if they still provide residual clues to what it is that we are experiencing. And on this score, the experience of being in the world but not of it is real, but the resources of previous ages, even if they exhibited greater receptivity to transcendence, are irrecoverably distant. So the argument goes. To put it a slightly different way, there is a brooding sense of the failure of modernity for those who cannot celebrate modernity. Now, a lot of what we've done today is to celebrate it, which I am quite happy to join in. But I think we have to understand that within the mentality of the university as we currently know it, there are those who find it difficult to celebrate modernity. And therefore, they have a brooding sense of failure and disillusionment. How does this differ from the experience of disillusionment with the claims of enlightenment, an experience which has been known for a long time? The strong form of this argument presumes a unique and radical discontinuity ruling out any restoration. Regret is overcome with the conviction that the traditions of high culture, liturgical practices, both sacred and civil, hierarchical order, great books and thinkers, are over and done with. Over against this is a desire for spiritual well-being, for philosophy understood as a way of life and not merely as an academic discipline. This can and does often urge us to hark back to ancient wisdom, but the connection is complicated by the unprecedented material and technical success of the West, which ties us tightly to the mundane world, even if there is something which draws us out of that world. Restoration on this argument requires an innocence we do not possess, something beyond an ironic sense of our situation. So, the argument goes, the age of transcendence may be over, but the longing for it, the longing for transcendence, is not over. If we have moved, as some modern historians would say, from providence to progress to frightful endlessness, there is nonetheless a residue that overhangs us. The idea that satisfying one desire after another leads to futility, that chronic dissatisfaction breeds resentment, is not new, as readers of Aristotle know. The ancient philosophers and theologians would agree with some of this diagnosis and recognize the symptoms of a spiritual disease while wondering at its putative novelty. If somehow truth has been given to us, must it not travel with us across historical boundaries through rediscovery and fresh formulation? Today we hover between acceptance of transhistorical truth and a profound skepticism regarding any such claim. We are aware of a rupture in the seamless web of historical occurrences. The desire for the transhistorical truth is contradicted by the fear of its manifestations, especially in the form of doctrinal or dogmatic formulas, of fanaticism, or in the fear of superstition. To be on this threshold is to resist relapsing into dependence on traditional resources, which may only be escapism. The standards for affirming and rejecting are hard to come by. Which at the same time reductively define those same human beings. Yet the liberty we possess must finally be liberty worthy of the name, that liberty which allows to be revealed somehow the purpose or meaning that it elicits and by which it is validated. Few would deny that a materialist notion of the good life is insufficient, yet many would argue that material well-being is a necessary condition of most of what is good for us. So at one and the same time, there is little disposition to reverse the achievements of modernity, but an agonizing uncertainty as to what the achievements of modernity point us to. Now, in the light of that situation, which I believe is a reasonable description of the context in which much of the debate in contemporary universities actually takes place, what do I say to my students? What I say to my students about tradition runs along these lines. We enjoy an inheritance of dialogue and reflection on politics. I teach political theory, so I'm going to use the politics as my illustration, but I believe this relates to virtually all of the disciplines of the humanities. We enjoy an inheritance of dialogue and reflection on politics handed down to us in a considerable number of books, both ancient and modern, that have come to be seen as especially full of insights of permanent value to us. We can thereby acquaint ourselves with a representative sample of those works from the time of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle to the American founding and beyond, as a means to make ourselves conversant with the complex range of thinking of the Western tradition. The tradition is neither static nor defined by a single thought or idea. It comprises constant actions both of preservation and innovation. A tradition is a complex, unsystematic whole in which there is both argument and agreement. One enters into it actively by becoming conversant with its range and complexity, with its internal tensions that are addressed and addressed again through time. One might think of a tradition as a dialogue extended through time. It began long before us and will very likely continue long after us. It is always incomplete, and there is always more to be said than has been said, but also what has been said before remains pertinent now as a guide to what is important to talk about. We do not, in short, begin from scratch, but from whatever point in this extended dialogue we have been given. We may like where we are, or we may wish things were otherwise. There will be both affirmation and criticism, agreement and disagreement, and perhaps agreement to disagree. That we are located in a tradition is unavoidable. How we choose to think about and make use of it is our responsibility, and that too is unavoidable. We are, one could say, both unavoidably constrained and unavoidably free. In this context, reading does not simply mean going through the material efficiently. Rather, it means trying to understand how the world looks in the views of those whose thoughts and arguments we encounter, how they may challenge and disagree with our assumptions, how they may reaffirm or strengthen them. Important books are important because they are the means by which we gain access to the full range of thinking that composes our tradition. Careful reading rescues us from the temporal parochialism that would confine our thinking to the here and now. In reflection and dialogue, the thoughts of our predecessors become present to us, and recognizable puzzles and predicaments of the human condition cast our immediate concerns into a larger historical perspective. We can make clearer to ourselves what is novel in our time and place and what is not. We can assess our hopes and aspirations in light of the vast array of hopes and aspirations history records. Thus, we seek to think carefully about the enduring questions of politics through careful reading and discussion. We seek to clarify the vocabulary of political discourse. We seek to understand how the American political tradition emerges out of and adapts the larger Western political tradition of which it is a signal part. We recognize that in discussing these matters, we will have both agreements and disagreements of opinion, that some issues necessarily are heartfelt and personal, but we share the common endeavor to understand better than we understood before, to become liberally educated, to accept the longer road of inquiry, whereon the inquiry is as important as the conclusions we may hope to reach. So far as we are individuals characterized by freedom and reason, then, we must each make out of our inquiries something for ourselves with the help and support of our common association in inquiry and dialogue. This is a joint inquiry into fundamental questions about our lives together. Now, considering what I would call then the intersection of the perennial and the historical, the following questions occur to me when I'm examining myself and my vocation to teach before I enter into these discussions with students. In teaching the Western tradition, I say to myself, is one bringing to sight truths valid in all times and places? Is one considering a progressive development in which greater approximations to truth are made over time so that we know more of what is true now than we could have known before? Have we departed from past insights such that we have declined rather than advanced? Does each era, remembering the difficulty of marking eras without arbitrariness, present us with what is true in its context, true for it but not true beyond it, and thus indicative neither of advance nor of decline, but only of transformation? Is there only an interminable succession of understandings that human beings have generated in responding to the contingent circumstances in which they have found themselves? If we grant that we must be implicated in and constrained by what has come before us, and that our self-understanding may be greater so far as we are aware of what we have been and where we have come from, does it follow that such comprehensiveness will endow meaning on us or protect us? Will it be, as Hegel said, that the only lesson we learn from history is that we never learn from history? What is the relation of historical understanding to the quest for wisdom? These are the questions through which I generate the conversation with myself that prepares me to converse with my students.